Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts this week are my colleagues, Naomi Martin.
Hi, Tristan.
And Naheed Rajwani.
Hey, Tristan.
We have a good show for you today. Our investigative reporter, Brooks Edgerton, will join us to talk about deadly dentistry, so that's a good one. We'll also talk a little bit about Ethan Couch of Affluenza fame. Our editorial writer, Mike Hashimoto, has a little something to say about that in his Hashing It Out segment. And our special guest today is Dallas Police Deputy Chief Jeff Kottner. He's going to talk to us about the open carry law, which takes effect, I believe, January 1st. Is that right, Naomi?
That's correct.
But we're going to go ahead and start today with Ethan Couch. Naheed, this was, as people might remember, this was the boy who was, I believe he was 15 or 16 in 2013 when he drove a pickup truck while drunk three times the adult legal limit. Pickup truck full of teenagers at a party and drove it into a stranded motorist and three Good Samaritans and killed all of them and actually injured some of the people in his truck. Naheed, where in the world is Ethan Couch?
Well, I don't know. You tell me. Really, the search authorities are now say that it's possible he may be out of the country. He didn't show up to his check-in with his probation officer. And so, the sheriff's office has said it's possible he had a really good head start on them. And they're having some fugitive officers looking for him. But who knows? I mean, he could be anywhere. And really, this case has been so interesting. It's because the sheriff's office has been very outspoken about whether or not they think Ethan Couch should be fleeing, and they've said they want him to come back, and they've urged the public to help them find him.
Do they think his mom is involved at all in this?
So, his attorneys released a statement on Tuesday saying that his mom and him haven't checked in with the probation officer, so it's possible authorities say that he might be with her.
I know very few other sort of notorious 16, or how old is he now? I guess he's 17,
he's
18.
18.
Well, he became notorious, at a young age. And obviously, having read the investigative report when it happened, it was just incredibly gruesome the way that these people died. And I think it stunned a lot of people that he got probation. What could happen to him upon return if he does come back?
The DA's office has said he could get up to 10 years in jail if it is determined that he violated the terms of his probation. Now, remember, there is that video that they're investigating that was on Twitter. And in that video, it's alleged that he was partying and drinking and playing beer pong. So that's also one other thing that could possibly work against him.
This is the one thing about probation that I think a lot of people don't understand, too, is it's not necessarily a free pass. In this case, as you mentioned, the beer pong aspect, you could get in trouble for that and you could be bounced right back into jail. The adult case, I believe they're transferring over from juvenile to adult. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. There is a motion in place to move that case on his 19th birthday from the juvenile system to the adult system, and that's pretty typical in cases like this.
Have you gotten any indication that may be sped up because of all this?
So there's been no information. The DA's office has been pretty quiet about what they're thinking and what they're doing, and we don't know whether or not that hearing that's scheduled about his case could possibly get moved up.
I guess it depends on whether he's around for the hearing.
Exactly.
Well, certainly it's an extraordinary case, and we'll be keeping an eye on it. It's one that got international attention because of the relatively light sentencing, considering that four people were horribly killed, four people who were relatively innocent, one of whom was, on the way home from his or on the way to back to the church to return chairs to after his son's graduation party. The other one was just a stranded motorist and a mother and daughter who, the father and husband came out and had to see an incredibly gruesome scene. When he thought they were just helping out outside of Burleson and Mansfield where this happened. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that. Thank you. Now joining us in the studio is our investigative reporter, Brooks Edgerton. Brooks, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
Well, Brooks, you have a Sunday series that's now out online and coming out, I believe, every Sunday for a while on deadly dentistry. And so why are you trying to scare people from going to the dentist?
Well, we're trying to educate people on how to go to the dentist, I think maybe is a better way to put it. Everybody needs to go. We all know that. And we're all responsible to some degree for our own dental care. But when we learned about the death of this child in Dallas and started digging and seeing some preliminary numbers, we realized that the problem of deadly dentistry and dangerous dentistry was a lot larger than it anybody knew, or almost anybody knew.
And you've talked about there's some sort of cover-up going on. Can you talk about why this is such a hidden problem and you had to uncover it?
Well, one thing we found along the way is that almost all states are doing a lousy job of tracking the numbers on this and talking about it and getting word out to patients and to disciplining the dangerous dentists. It took forever to get real numbers from Texas, and in most other states, we never did get real numbers. A lot of them said they simply didn't know what they were, even though they were collecting reports of death. They weren't adding them up. They just went off to separate files and vanished.
So for people who haven't started reading this yet, how old was the child again?
The child in Dallas was four.
It was a four-year-old child who went to the dentist to initially what they thought was four crowns, right?
That's right. He went to the family dentist for – family dentist says, needs four crowns. He's too wiggly for me. I can't do any sedation beyond the most basic nitrous oxide. I don't think that's going to cut it. Let's go get you to a pediatric specialist. She refers the family to another guy who's supposedly had the advanced training in how to drug children. And it turned out that he was using about twice the dose that's approved by the very dental school that he got his training at.
So the terrifying thing about this to me, obviously this spurred a couple of other stories about other people or children who had suffered, is that I have always tended to put dentistry in sort of the same category as like chiropractic. It just seems like it's more there is a surgery involved in it, but it seems a lot more cosmetic than perhaps invasive. But in this case, you tend to forget they can dope you up, that these are dangerous drugs and they have to be administered correctly. Could you tell us a little bit about the process of you know, I imagine you probably don't have a, you know, PhD in you know, nitrous oxide and how that's done. Could you tell us a little bit about the process on how you went through this and found that these drugs were not being used safely by a handful of dentists?
Well, it like any other story, once you dig in, you figure out who the experts are and what the resource texts are, what the laws are, the rules. And the story was reported in really in much the same way any investigative story would be, reading the documents carefully, knowing what the laws and the rules are and what the standards are. In this case, I had to do a lot of reading of drug packaging information to make sure I understood what recommended dosages were.
I bet that was riveting.
It was riveting. Yeah. So, in this case, you know, the open records process, since we were dealing with all three of Texas's dental schools are public institutions, so they had to provide records showing what dosages they taught and approved. So there are ways to get to it.
What was it like, you know, you have all this information and then in some of these stories it seemed like some were brief encounters, but you talked to these dentists who had been accused of, well, they what happened was people died in their care. What was that like for you?
Well, in the Dallas case, I think I had all of about 30 seconds of conversation with the dentist in question. So and that took about 17 tries to get that much. So I don't have a whole lot to say about that guy. Other people talked to me at significant length repeatedly. One guy who had two patients die in a little over a year in Las Vegas and then simply moved to Texas and started over. He had a full story, you know, on everything being somebody else's fault, other than his. And yet, saying that he was haunted by the deaths all the same.
Is dentistry worse than, say, like medicine in terms of disciplining bad dentists?
I don't think I know enough to answer that. Medicine does get more scrutiny. Doctors get more scrutiny, I think, because they tend to be associated with larger institutions much more frequently than dentists. They, you know, many of them will have a connection to a hospital where they can admit their patients. Most dentists don't have that. Many dentists are solo practitioners. Some people call dentistry a cottage industry still, in that it's kind of isolated from the rest of healthcare in a way that medicine's not.
For people who want to go to the dentist but don't want to die, How do you find out, how do you find out information on your dentist to know that they haven't been disciplined?
Well, every state has an agency that's assigned to protect the public from bad dentists. Often it's called a dental board. I think if you Google your state's name and the words dental board, you can find the database that's online in most states' cases, although quite a few big ones still do a really poor job with this. At any rate, you can find the dentist, look up their profile, see if they have a history, and the good states will give you a direct link to the disciplinary documents.
Does Texas do that?
Texas does and has a really long memory, a big archive of records going back several decades. Texas, believe it or not, is one of the better states when it comes to openness and record keeping.
What could the government have done better in preventing stuff like this from happening?
Well, one thing that definitely failed in Texas, the state dental board has the right, when deciding whether to give you a sedation license, which comes in addition to your dental license, they have the right to inspect your premises and your methods before they give out this license. And what we found in the reporting was that they had never actually done that with anybody, including the dentist here in Dallas. And now that he's on unsupervised probation for this death, they have the right to kind of come in and, jump him at any moment, come into his office and check his records. And again, we found they've never done that.
So what has been the reaction to the story so far?
Well, I haven't had any truly angry responses from dentists, which I was expecting. Professional societies have been very quiet and tame in their responses. Quite a number of dentists have told me how glad they are that this story is finally being told. They knew that there were problems. I had one dentist call me in tears last week after reading the first story, talking about a death that he had consulted with a family on 10 years ago in Houston, and how he had been telling the state dental board over and over again that this problem was going to keep happening and that more kids were going to die and that nothing had really changed.
All right. Brooks Edgerton, thank you very much for joining us. You can read his stories online at dallasnews.com. I believe it's a 7-part series. Is that right?
Yeah, depending on how you cut it up.
How you consume it.
So yeah. There's more coming on this Sunday and Monday, and the whole thing's on at just Google Dallas News Deadly Dentistry.
You can find it on our website. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
So starting January 1st, you may see people walking around with handguns on their hips as the state's new open carry law goes into effect. I have Deputy Chief Jeff Cotner from Dallas Police Department here in the studio with me to talk about what this means for you all out there and for the police who are enforcing the new law. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Naomi.
So what do you want the public to know as they, start encountering these people, possibly in the grocery store or at the park, who are openly carrying guns?
Well, for the citizens of Dallas and certainly in this community, I want them to let them know they're safe, their police department is prepared, the officers are being trained, the 911 operators are being trained, and that the citizens that are exercising this privilege have been vetted. So there's been a process when they apply, and also that they've gone through extensive training, and part of their training is that they understand how to interact with police officers and certainly interact in the community.
And so if someone is alarmed at the sight of a gun, what do you recommend they do?
Unalarmed, this is legal. So someone may be alarmed, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's offense. So what we're doing, when I say we, the city of Dallas is doing an educational campaign right now. The citizens have an opportunity, if they haven't already heard, about license to carry, which is the legal term for open carry, where they can get additional information. They can go to the city of Dallas website. They can go to they can call 311 and they can get additional information. We've put an FAQ page that's quite extensive that should be valuable to our citizens so they get the information. However, if the individual that they see, that it is acting in a manner in which they believe to be suspicious or concerning. They believe them to be in a location in which they're not authorized, because there are some prohibitions where they can do open carry. They call 911 in those circumstances.
And are you guys expecting an uptick in 911 calls about this, at least at the beginning?
You know, we may see an uptick. We have set aside, the Dallas Police Department has set aside a special signal, which signal 28, for open carry calls. So we'll be able to monitor and track those calls. We think that we'll see initially an uptick, and then it will then eventually even itself out. And, you know, the thing to remember here is that license to carry is going to be the 21st year. In that the concealed handgun license, you know, began in 1996. We've got 20 years of citizens exercising this privilege with minimal impact to our society. The open carry adds a little bit of an ingredient. The citizens need to be aware that in order to open carry, someone has to have it in a holster on their belt or in a holster on a shoulder. So, you know, I think we're going to get some calls, Naomi. I do believe it's going to even itself out in time.
And you mentioned something to me when we were talking about this earlier, that police have actually not had that many problems with concealed carry handgun owners, that they actually tend to be law-abiding citizens, right?
Absolutely. Part of the training regimen that is required to obtain a concealed handgun license, again, it'll be a license to carry, is how to interact with law enforcement and how to interact in the community. So just really minimal to no issues over the past 20 years. So I expect a smooth transition in that regard. One of the other things that the Dallas Police Department is doing is we're interacting with the local open carry advocates, and they have connections, and they're very supportive of our actions to prepare and train, and they're assisting us. And so we're looking forward to a cooperative effort.
How does this change the police's job on the street? Because in the past, they would see a person with a handgun visible, you know, maybe in the car or walking down the street. That was a crime. So how does this change now?
Okay, so this is an interesting point. And so, you know, let's work over this and let's make sure we have clarity here. Just because you're merely wearing a handgun in the manner in which I described, it's not a violation of the law. It is the law, and it's authorized. Okay. Now, if you don't have the handgun in a holster, if in any way that you're manipulating it or brandishing it, causing excessive alarm, okay, then that would be reasonable suspicion for police officers to take action. If an officer observes an individual and they believe that they're committing an offense or some sort of crime, that is reasonable suspicion, and officers can make contact.
What are some of the officers' like most common questions that you're hearing as you're over the training academy at DPD, and so you're in charge of making sure the officers are all aware of these changes? Are you hearing any common questions or concerns from the officers?
You know, actually, it's turned out to be a great refresher for us. When you have 20 years of a law, it becomes something that you just kind of do and you forget. So the refresher piece was that officers can disarm individuals under circumstances to protect the license holder, the officer, and any others. So it's a reminder that we have that. It's also a reminder that if someone is a license holder and they commit some sort of violation of a law, or they violate, their license holder statute, then we can also do a affidavit to the Texas Department of Public Safety so that there can be some sort of review that might result in a suspension or revocation of an individual's privilege.
Is there anything else that you think people should know about this or keep in mind as January 1st rolls around?
Naomi, the message I want everybody to know is that they're going to be safe and that we're prepared and to respond to anything we need to do. And if anyone has any questions, we encourage them to call their local police division, and we'll help them out individually.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
That just about does it for us today. We will have a new Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto next. But before we go, we want to thank you for listening. Remember, you can catch our show every Thursday on iTunes. Next week, we'll have a special show on the juvenile justice system. Jen Emily will be taking the lead on that. And remember, you can read all of these stories you heard today and more on DallasNews.com. You can also like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast on Twitter. Our producer and sound engineers today are Tommy Noel and Brian Elledge. Thanks again to Jeff Kotner and Brooks Edgerton. For Naomi Martin and Naheed Rajwani, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
If you know Ethan Couch or his mom, let them know that people are looking for them. Official people, the law enforcement kind. Ethan, if you remember, was 16 when he got really drunk and drove his daddy's pickup into some folks trying to aid a stranded driver near Fort Worth. Four of them died. Others were seriously injured. Ethan, the luckiest kid on earth, ended up in front of a judge, Gene Boyd, who bought what became known as the affluenza defense. In short, this wasn't young Ethan's fault because his parents gave him all the material things, but no values, like accountability. Judge Boyd swooned and it sentenced Ethan to 10 years, 10 years probation, along with taxpayer-funded rehab. If you're shaking your head, you're not alone. Oh, Ethan would turn up again, this time allegedly on a cell phone video of teens playing beer pong. If you're old like me, that's a drinking game, and drinking would violate Ethan's probation. Now he's ditched a meeting with his probation officer and is nowhere to be found. Officials think he and his mom might have fled the country, one without an extradition treaty, I think. Maybe mom is doing the driving, let's hope so, and not a young man who never fails to sink to the occasion.